From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, how YouTube is working to stop viewers from recreating dangerous pranks like setting themselves on fire or driving while blindfolded. Then how the heavily hyped Fyre Music Festival became synonymous with fraud and failure.
They created this amazing facade of this luxury festival, but what was beneath it, you know, was non-existent. They didn't know how they would achieve these results.
And the Museum of Contemporary Art in downtown Los Angeles explores the world of painter Manny Farber. All that after this short break. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Every day, hundreds of thousands of hours of new video content is uploaded on YouTube. Much of it is promotional, say movie trailers. A fair amount is silly, like cat and dog tricks gone wrong. But there are also a lot of videos with dangerous content, stunts, challenges, and pranks. And as more people try to replicate what happens in those videos, the risk for injury, or worse, is growing. Yesterday, YouTube, which is part of Google parent Alphabet, released new guidelines for how it will monitor and block such content. Julia Alexander is a tech and internet culture reporter for The Verge, and when we spoke this morning, I asked what concerns YouTube most about these kinds of videos.
What YouTube is really most concerned about, and this is something that they've really tried to work into their language of community guidelines over the last year or two, is children that are involved. So you'll see a bunch of creators kind of do really scary pranks with kids, where they'll fake a home invasion.
Yes, hello. I just scared my brother and he's having, I don't know if it's a panic attack, but he's shaking.
If it leaves a child clearly very scared, or clearly they're not sure what's happening, or it's at the expense of a child, those are the videos that YouTube is specifically trying to target. And in these situations, the video will be removed and a channel will receive a community guideline strike. And so just to put that into perspective, if a channel collects 3 community guideline strikes within a 90-day period, their account will be terminated.
The problem is that YouTube has thousands of new videos that are uploaded probably every minute of every day. So how can the company or viewers possibly police all of them? And isn't it possible by the time that anything that is problematic is spotted or flagged, it's too late?
So YouTube has about 450 hours of content uploaded every minute, every day, which is insane. That's a lot of videos. No one can police that amount of videos. That's been an issue for YouTube for quite some time. Users, of course, can flag a video and they can report it for something that's disturbing or possibly dangerous and harmful. That's still not going to hit every single video. What YouTube, I think, is trying to specifically tackle is the prevention of trends and challenges. A lot of dangerous pranks that happen on YouTube happen to have the word challenge attached to it. So you have things like the Fyre challenge.
There's the Fyre challenge right here. We do it with the green alcohol, baby.
In which people play with fire. You have, at one point, there was a concern over something called the boiling water challenge.
I'm going to do the hot water challenge.
No, Dad, don't do it.
Jason, no.
Which didn't actually morph into anything. But the idea would have been, hey, like, can you pour boiling water on yourself? Which no one tried because there is still, I guess, some common sense left. But the idea is that if this became a trend or a challenge on YouTube, they could kind of just look up the title and start going through and handing things out.
How much of a factor is the age of some YouTube viewers? They're of an impressionable age. They may be adolescents. They may be teens. And also, even if they have to enter a birth date or an age, can't they just fake that?
Of course. This has been the situation with the internet since the internet was founded. So with Google, that means creating a fake Gmail that says you're 18. I mean, that gets you around YouTube's age gate. It's not a perfect solution. It's nowhere near a perfect solution. It all depends on the creator and their audience. So someone like Jake Paul, who's a very popular creator, who was one of the people who posted himself driving blindfolded.
Jake Paul's Bird Box Challenge video was ripped from YouTube after showing the YouTuber walking into heavy traffic.
He has said multiple times on the record that he believes his audience is between 8 and 16 years old. That's incredibly young.
Yeah.
And that's an audience of people who really do believe in everything he does. And so I think YouTube explicitly looks at creators like that draw millions of views and are pretty well known among advertisers. And this is who YouTube is saying, listen, we really want to make sure that they're not posting content, because the idea, based on my kind of expertise, is that if top creators aren't getting 10 million views for a dangerous stunt video, then it might discourage those looking to kind of broaden their channels and gain more subscribers and gain more views from participating in similar stunts.
It's easy to assume there are a couple of motivations for YouTube's announcement. One is the altruistic public safety concern. The other is the selfish concern about being sued, the threat of litigation. Is there any indication that YouTube is worried about potential lawsuits and what that could cost the company? Or are they just doing this out of the goodness of their heart?
I don't think YouTube is necessarily worried about lawsuits. I think YouTube is worried about something that the creator culture refers to as an adpocalypse. Adpocalypse is basically anytime something really severe happens on YouTube. Think about Logan Paul uploading the video of finding a dead body in the forest in Japan. Advertisers flee. They tend to say, well, we don't trust the product right now. We don't trust the platform. And if I'm Nike, I don't want to give you millions of dollars for my videos. So what YouTube does, and CEO Susan Wojcicki has spoken about this multiple times, they try to balance helping out their creators, ensuring that their viewers are having a safe and good time on the platform, and then also ensuring that advertisers feel safe. So when YouTube comes out and says, we don't want dangerous stunt videos, even though they bring in millions and millions of views, I think what they're doing is dressing all three of these situations. They're saying, we don't want creators perpetuating that this is what YouTube is. We want advertisers to feel safe that if they put an ad on a video, it's not going to be someone doing something reckless. And also, they do want to ensure parents and their users that their kids aren't going to watch dangerous content that they then might want to replicate. The idea is hopefully this will discourage creators from trying to pull off dangerous stunts in search of the next kind of big video.
Julia Alexander is a tech internet culture reporter at The Verge. Julia, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, the Fyre Music Festival was supposed to be a first-class event. Two documentaries show how that promise turned into a criminal fiasco.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm your host, John Horn. If you know anything about the Fyre Festival in 2017, you know that it was a complete disaster. And I really hope you didn't buy tickets. Creators Billy McFarland and rapper Ja Rule sold Fyre as a luxury music festival with first-class travel, supermodels galore, and an all-star lineup of bands. But the reality, as hundreds of fleeced festival goers would find out when they arrived in the Bahamas, couldn't have been further from McFarland's sales pitch. Almost instantly, the Fyre fiasco was all over social media, news, and even late-night TV.
We had no electricity, there was no showers, there's no bathrooms, there's no, like, running water.
Man, white people love camping unless it's a surprise.
But the fallout was not a joke. Billy McFarland was sentenced to 6 years in prison for defrauding investors and starting a separate ticket-selling scam while he was out on bail. Ja Rule was named as a co-defendant in separate lawsuits, some of which are still pending. Now, there are two documentaries out this week about what happened, the Netflix movie Fyre and Hulu's Fyre Fraud. I'd recommend you watch both if you're into that kind of thing, even if both come with caveats. The Hulu documentary includes an interview with McFarland, for which he was paid to talk. The Netflix documentary was produced in partnership with two companies that promoted the festival. I recently spoke with Chris Smith. He's the writer-director of the Netflix documentary Fyre, and he explained the expectations that people had going to the Fyre Festival.
it sort of played into everything that you could want. Like, it was private jets going down to a private island, great food, great, you know, access to celebrity.
The actual experience exceeds all expectations and is something that's hard to put into words. All these things that may seem big and impossible are not.
They did a marketing video for the festival, which the pitch was basically you could come down and have this luxurious experience for one of two different weekends, and these bands would be playing. It'd be this amazing getaway.
Yeah, I remember seeing that video myself. I'm wondering when you first heard about the festival. Was it before or when the wheels started coming off?
I heard about it when the wheels started coming off. I started seeing the news stories pop up, and that was the first time it got on my radar.
You know, it's become one of the most talked about dramas on social media.
Glamorous, luxurious Caribbean
island getaway turned disaster.
Quickly spiraling into chaos.
Now the event's co-founder is facing up to 20 years in prison.
There is somebody who is central to this story, and his name is Billy McFarland. And it seems like from the very start, he was shady in his business dealings. And I think shady is a kind word. So what was Billy's background, and who is he as the Fyre Festival is coming up?
Billy grew up in Short Hills, New Jersey. From what we can tell, he dropped out of college. He was a serial entrepreneur. He was doing small hustles or businesses while he was in middle school and high school. And then he had two companies before Fyre. One was Spling, which he had sold and exited on. And the other one was Magnesis, which was a black card for millennials and a clubhouse that started in New York City but expanded to other cities around the country.
When you look at some of his history, including the credit card, it looks like everything that he said he was doing was not actually what he was doing. And it got me thinking, Bernie Madoff obviously ran a Ponzi scheme, but at a certain point, Bernie Madoff was a real investment advisor. Is there any evidence that Billy McFarland was ever a legitimate businessman, or was everything from the get-go a hustle?
I think his intentions were real. Like, I don't think that he wanted people to fly down to an island in the Bahamas and have a half-put-together festival await them. I think his goal was to deliver what they had shown in the video. I think just the reality of that, you know, of trying to live up to that promise ended up being much more than anyone on the internal team expected.
One of the things that's amazing about your movie is the extraordinary amount of behind-the-scenes footage that you have leading up to the festival, during the festival, and in its aftermath, and in a key sequence after everything has really gone to hell. How did you find that footage, and why did it exist?
You know, I think we're in an era of self-documentation or documentation. I think, you know, everyone has a camera in their pocket with their phone, so they're able to sort of document the world in ways that maybe we didn't have quite the same access, you know, before the iPhone. So in terms of like the festival breakdown, a lot of that was covered just by the attendees. But a lot of the other footage was just in different places.
I directed the commercial. One camera crew was shooting with the models. And they had kind of like a dedicated film crew, like shooting the dialogue between Billy and his people. There was no like, this is the story we want to tell, this is what we want to capture. They were just capture everything.
I think it's fair to say that a lot of people were overwhelmed by Billy's charisma, that he was a good talker, he made a lot of promises, and yet a lot of people thought that maybe this was too good to be true, and yet they still went along for the ride. You talked to somebody who's a pilot named Keith. Terrifyingly, he's self-taught. He learned to fly on Microsoft Flight Simulator, and he's a friend of Billy's. And we're going to play a clip where he starts to wonder very early on if the logistics for the festival are doable.
They really wanted to do tents. So what I did is I took my wife and we tried to sleep in a tent for one night. And it was so terrible that, you know, this tent is just not going to be safe. And it's so loud, so many mosquitoes. To do this tents without air conditioning is pretty brutal. It's just not possible. So I strongly recommend it against the tents.
Keith raised a lot of concerns about these things. And then I think he was asked to no longer be part of it.
This seems to be a problem, is that people who raise issues are either ignored or they're let go of. Was that a pattern of behavior that almost encouraged the yes men to stick around?
You know, it's hard to make a blanket statement about everyone and everyone's experience. I think, you know, different people were brought in at different times. The contractors that actually tried to pull the festival off, most of them were brought in 6 to 8 weeks before the festival was supposed to happen. So they were sort of faced with an impossible challenge. And I think a lot of them actually just sort of tried to make this become less of a disaster than it was already destined to be.
You talk with a lot of people who are in different ways victimized by Billy McFarland. I have to say, one of the most heartbreaking stories is a woman named Marianne. Let's play a clip from Marianne talking about what happened to her during the festival.
I had 10 persons working directly with me, just preparing food all day and all night, 24 hours. I had to literally pay all those people. I am here as a Bahamian, and they stand in my face every day. I went through about $50,000 of my savings that I could have had for any day. And just they just wipe it out and never look back.
You know, fire had this reputation on the island of being very high profile. Money was not a problem. And so I don't think that there was a lot of reason to question it. You know, you looked at the caliber of talent that was associated and sort of, there was a lot of money being spent. You know, they were flying down on private jets. So I think the people, you know, just assumed that when money would be tight or they wouldn't get paid, that it was just, everyone was overwhelmed and it was just a logistical thing. But of course, you know, that the money would be there. So Marianne, you know, ended up in a situation where she started feeding the entire staff. I don't think that they had that figured out. And so she was providing meals for all the laborers that were actually building the festival site. And so in that process, you know, she ended up investing a lot of her own money just to keep the operation moving forward, because everything, I think, was just so down to the wire that there was really no time, you know, to stop and do an invoice or anything like that. It was really just, we just have to get through the festival and then everyone will be made whole.
One of the things that strikes me about Billy McFarland is not just how easy lying came to him, but the scale of the lying. He ran this app, which was basically a way to book talent for concerts. And he claimed that there were thousands of offers representing tens of millions of dollars of fees. In fact, he had 60 bookings and they'd only made $57,000. So it wasn't just that he was a fabulist. The scale of his lies were like Mount Everest in height, weren't they?
Yes. I mean, you know, there became a point where I think, you know, and this is speculation, that the festival was the only way out and that he had to pull the festival off because that would become the asset that could potentially get him out of the hole that he was in. And so in a way, the intention could have been, this is the only way that everyone doesn't lose everything. And I don't know, because we didn't talk to Billy, I don't know, but when I tried to put myself in his shoes, I would have to imagine that that was part of the mindset.
Did you try to talk to Billy, and what did he say in response?
You know, we were in talks with Billy. We were supposed to film him, I think, on two different occasions. But in the end, it came down to, you know, the fact that Billy wanted to get paid, and we didn't feel comfortable with him benefiting after so many people were hurt based on his actions.
There are so many ways to look at the lessons of this story and what this film is ultimately about. How would you describe the broader idea?
I think one aspect really plays into this idea of perception versus reality. You know, they created this amazing facade of this luxury festival, but what was beneath it, you know, was non-existent. You know, they hadn't planned the festival. They didn't know how they would achieve these results. So I think, you know, that there's a lot of parallels in terms of the way that people may represent themselves online, and you sort of see the physical manifestation of that idea in Fire.
Chris Smith is the writer and director of Fire. It's on Netflix and in theaters on January 18th. Chris, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks.
Coming up, a museum exhibit about the influential artist and critic Manny Farber.
Bring out our emotions, mix them up in that life potion.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The Museum of Contemporary Art currently has an eclectic group show that features the work of the influential painter and film critic Manny Farber and other modern artists who represent his aesthetic. Mark Haefeli reports on both sides of the artist and critic and how they intersected.
Manny Farber didn't like many movies, but his reviews reveal a love for all film, including movies most critics avoided. His paintings are sprawling tabletop works combining collage and still lifes. Helen Molesworth curated One Day at a Time at MoCA.
I think for Manny, the way he looked at film, the way he painted his paintings, the way he wrote his essays, for him were all of a piece. They were all a struggle, and they all required a very close attention to detail.
The detail in his work is personal, going on autobiographical. He paints a great deal of the quotidian, the daily life of Farber and his wife Patricia, like floral arrangements, fruit and produce from the family garden, snapshots, personal notes, and dishes of prepared food. He often sets his works at odd angles or has you hover directly over a table filled with the stuff of everyday life. Looking at one of his big paintings at MoCA, an oil from 1984, I can only begin to list all the mundane objects in it. Half pint of blueberries, a plate of shellfish, some crackers, a tureen full of who knows what, a loaf of fresh baked bread, a candle and a candlestick. This is the same kind of detail Farber most admires in film.
Yeah, so I wish you hadn't done that, Hilly.
Done what?
Divorce me. Makes a fella lose all faith in himself. Almost gives him a feeling he wasn't wanted.
Here's Farber himself describing Cary Grant in His Girl Friday in the documentary On Detour with Manny Farber.
To see Cary Grant doing something overwhelms me. To know about what characters he's playing doesn't overwhelm me at all. It always is important for me to be able to get to describing a scene physically, the gestures and the grimaces and the costumes and the people he's talking to, how far away they are. How can it not be? That strikes me as the most important element.
Farber died in Encinitas in 2008 at the age of 81. He is best known for his central aesthetic view explained in a famous essay titled White Elephant Art versus Termite Art, which is also the controlling theme of the MoCA exhibit.
Termite art is about the details. Termite art is about the overlooked. Termite art is about the process of an artist falling down her rabbit hole and not looking up to see where she's going or where she's been.
On the other hand, White Elephant Art is about making a big splash. So Farber vaunts directors like Howard Hawks and John Ford over Antonioni and Truffaut, and even Billy Wilder.
Well, nobody's perfect.
Born in 1917 in the tiny border town of Douglas, Arizona, Farber moved as a young man to New York, where he worked as a carpenter while he developed his painting. In 1942, he joined the New Republic as film critic and later wrote for Time and even the low-end men's magazine, Cavalier. Farber kept at it for 28 years and, film critic and scholar Jonathan Rosenbaum says, took it very seriously.
He considered film criticism an art form, and I do too. I don't think there are many of us among film critics, though, who do. I think usually film critics are considered parasites, you know, like that they're totally dependent on the works of art and it's like they're just sort of these appendages. But I think that he actually saw criticism as a higher calling than that and something that was very exploratory in the same way that painting was exploratory.
And in his movie reviews, Farber wrote for himself.
The funny thing about him is he writes with a kind of sarcasm that you often can't tell whether he likes the movie or doesn't like the movie. And that's what's interesting about him. Like, I think of all major critics, he's the only one I can think of who, as far as I know, was never, ever used in an ad.
For the MoCA show, Molesworth intermixes the work of other modern artists she feels were influenced by or otherwise represented Farber's aesthetic.
It's filled with objects that I love, that I have kind of carried around with me in my head. The choices of work in the show are like deeply personal. This is me saying to the viewer, like, psst, come over here, look at this. This is really cool.
Like Catherine Opie's photos of the inside of Elizabeth Taylor's home, full-color photo still lifes from Wolfgang Tillmans, and some very impressive representative painting by Farber's wife and co-worker, Patricia Patterson. My personal favorite is a massive derelict 1920s tractor recast in bright aluminum by Charles Ray. It's just a broken-down tractor, but Ray is saying it deserves attention.
I think this work is really conceptual and really difficult. It is also really relatable and really accessible. And in that regard, it makes it a lot like people.
As Farber puts it in his essay, termite art feels its way with no sign that the artist has any object in mind other than eating away the immediate boundaries of his art. At the press preview for One Day at a Time, I asked Helen Molesworth, why Manny Farber? Why now?
I am not a fan of the current art world.
This may be the understatement of the year. Molesworth was fired as MoCA's chief curator in March, apparently for conflicting with MoCA trustees who prefer blue chip art.
I find it bloated and concerned with things that are not interesting to me, like money and popularity. And Manny didn't give a f*** about popularity, and he didn't give a f*** about money, and he painted still life paintings of flowers cut from his wife's garden.
One Day at a Time, Manny Farber and Termite Art is at MoCA on Grand Avenue through March 11th. For The Frame, I'm Mark Haefeling.
And on a related note, the Museum of Contemporary Art is closing its space at the Pacific Design Center in West Hollywood. MoCA has presented shows there for more than 20 years. And that's the show for today. Thanks for joining us. I'm John Horn. We'll see you back here tomorrow.